This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 140, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 120 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Jeffrey Mishlove about his book, UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Jeff is a doctor of parapsychology, where he got his PhD from Berkeley. Between 1986 and 2002, he hosted and co-produced the Thinking Aloud television series. He is a past vice president for the Association of Humanistic Psychology and is the recipient of the Pathfinder Award from that association. He is also past president of the non-profit Intuition Network. Hi, Jeff. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? And this is a book where you have different chapters with different people, isn't it? And you're discussing the UFO subject.
These are all guests on the New Thinking Aloud YouTube channel. And we took what we thought were about 15 of the most interesting conversations regarding UFOs, some of them going back to the original Thinking Aloud public television series, which goes back to 1986. And so we have interviews, for example, with John Mack, the great Harvard psychiatrist who began researching UFO abduction cases and nearly got kicked out of Harvard University because of his interest in this phenomena. But many other more recent people as well. So in every instance, I am the interviewer and the guests are the ones who are the experts.
So when did you get first interested in UFOs?
As a child, I think at the age of 10, I was probably in about the third or fourth grade. In school, I began going to the public library and reading every book I could find on the subject. And this is back in the 1950s when UFOs were a hot topic, as a matter of fact, back then. And actually, even as a 10-year-old, I wrote a letter to one of the authors, Donald Menzel, who was an astronomer at Harvard University in the astronomy department and a real skeptic. And, you know, I scrawled out a letter probably written in crayon or something. And he actually answered me back with an assurance, in case I misunderstood his book, that there was no such thing as UFOs.
Oh, boy. And did that kind of put you off? I mean, did you have other people around you that you couldn't talk to because they thought you were crazy?
Well, I was a kid at the time. And, you know, kids are given a lot of latitude in this sort of thing. And I remember very clearly getting the letter back from him and being surprised by it. But it may have actually dampened my interest temporarily in UFOs. I really had the next big awakening into the UFO area in, well, it was about 1972 when I sponsored Uri Geller's first major public appearance in the United States at the University of California, Berkeley, where I was then a graduate student, and Andrea Puharich as well, the medical doctor who had discovered Geller and wrote the first biography of Geller. They were all very clear in those days that Geller's apparent psychic abilities, which were quite remarkable, and to this day, I'll stand by them. There have been dozens of scientific papers in the early days, and certainly in Puharich's book, Geller attributed his unusual paranormal abilities to UFO encounters he had had throughout his life. And Puharich validated that and wrote about them in the book. And in fact, I even went so far as to interview one of the companions who was with Puharich and Geller in Israel witnessing UFOs. She was a psychologist named Isla Zeebel from Madison, Wisconsin. And she confirmed for me that the reports written by Puharich were valid, that she was also a witness to them. Later on, of course, Uri Geller began to downplay it. I think he felt that it was just too overwhelming for people to digest both the fact that he had these unusual psychokinetic abilities, bending spoons, for example, which became a very popular activity. People were holding spoon bending parties all over the United States. And so he didn't deny the UFO connection, but he just sought to de-emphasize it in his work. But I remembered it, of course. And then in 1976, I encountered a fellow named Ted Owens, who also had extraordinary psychokinetic abilities. And that came about because I was visiting SRI International. It was then, in those days, called the Stanford Research Institute. And that's where Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ were pioneering their work in remote viewing, working with Ingo Swann. And they invited me to come visit the laboratory and experience remote viewing for myself, which I did. But when I got there, they were all buzzing around about this Ted Owens character who had been writing to them. You see, they had done some of the early research with Uri Geller and had achieved some notoriety, had been written up in Time magazine and elsewhere. And so Ted Owens was sending them letters saying, "Why are you wasting your time with Uri Geller? I'm the world's greatest psychic. You should be testing me." And he kept badgering them in this way. And actually, they were getting funding from the CIA and other government intelligence agencies. So the last thing they wanted was a flamboyant psychic associated with their laboratory. In fact, I think they felt even a bit embarrassed by all the notoriety that their work with Uri Geller had resulted in. But Ted Owens kept persisting. And he, at one point, shortly before my visit, had sent them a letter saying, "I'm going to prove to you that I am the world's greatest psychic, because I know you are experiencing a drought in California right now, and I'm going to telepath to my UFOs, and we're going to end the drought. And you will know that we did it because the local newspaper in your community will write an article saying the drought is over, and there will be every kind of freak weather phenomenon, and there will be UFO sightings." And actually, all of that happened within about 3 days of receiving the letter from Ted Owens, which is remarkable because at the time he wrote the letter, the newspapers were all saying no end in sight to the drought. So I recall Russell Targ sent him back a little note saying that was a good prediction. And Ted Owens responded by saying, "That was no prediction, I caused it." So all of this was happening right when I showed up at their laboratory. And what they wanted was somebody to pick up and research this case, but it couldn't be them. And here I was, a promising graduate student with an interest in the paranormal. And so they were very happy to give me all of their files. And I followed up. I actually met Ted Owens that summer in Europe at a parapsychology convention. And we struck up a friendship, and I was very interested in his ability to produce UFOs on demand. And he promised he would do that for me, Simon. And we set up a test, I tried to make it as careful as I could under the circumstances. It was difficult because Owens was a flamboyant figure and he didn't give me a lot of time to plan carefully, but he said he would produce three major sightings within 100 miles of San Francisco. So in order to establish a proper control group, because I had no idea how often UFOs would appear anyway, by chance alone, I arranged for some friends of mine in San Diego to monitor that area and see if, and then over the 90-day period that we were looking at, if UFOs would be seen over San Diego, a West Coast city with a similar population. And it turned out there were none. No UFOs reported within 100 miles of San Diego during that 90-day window, but there were in the San Francisco Bay Area. And at one time, Owens called me on the phone in early December 1976, and he said to me, "Jeffrey, I feel this one coming. It's going to be the biggest, best UFO sighting ever. It's going to be seen by hundreds of people. It's going to be photographed, and the photograph will be published on the front page of one of your local newspapers." And to my astonishment, that actually happened just a few days after his statement. And the way it occurred was that the art department at Sonoma State College, a small university now known as Sonoma State University, about 50 miles north of San Francisco in a little town called Rohnert Park, the art department was sponsoring an event with an artist who was also an airplane pilot named Stephen Pileski. And he had a little airplane and he would have smoke trailing out the back and he was making designs in the sky with his smoke. And this was considered an artistic event. So the whole art department was out there with their cameras. Stephen Pileski is flying above the college campus and a UFO appeared right in his airspace. It was photographed. It was actually videotaped. It was seen by hundreds of people on the ground and in the air by the pilot at the same time. The Berkeley Gazette on December 12th published a front page article with a photo, and the videotape of that event was actually broadcast on the Channel 9 Evening News, KQED, in San Francisco. I would say at the time, it was probably the most well-attested UFO sighting ever. Although, you know, it quickly, it was a brief flap, you know, people didn't linger and research it. But I still have the videotape. We interviewed the witnesses, and it was a valid sight. So by then, I had no doubt whatsoever that not only were UFOs real, but that they had a relationship, an undeniable relationship to paranormal phenomena. Ted Owens claimed that he was in telepathic contact with what he called the space intelligences. And, well, I wrote a book about it called The PK Man. PK means psychokinesis, or mind over matter. And Owens produced hundreds of demonstrations of psychokinetic abilities involving typically large-scale phenomena like the weather, tornadoes, earthquakes, hurricanes, droughts, and the like, power blackouts, UFO sightings. So I guess you could say I was primed long before we published this book, except that something's going on out there.
Oh, you talk to Daz Smith in the book, who's part of the remote viewing community, and he talks about remote viewing things on the moon and other planets. Did they see stuff that was extraterrestrial happening there?
Daz Smith, well, he's one of your fellow countrymen. He lives in England. And I interviewed him about a very unusual book written by Ingo Swann, who was the person who helped develop the whole protocol for remote viewing at SRI International. And Ingo Swann wrote what I think is his most mysterious book called Penetration. And it's written as a book of nonfiction, although it's so bizarre, it's hard to know. Could he have actually meant to write it as fiction? Although I don't think it would have been very good fiction. And it was, he describes being with a group of mysterious people, government agents or agents from some secret organization who worked with him and took him in some sort of transport, an airplane or a helicopter, way up north to some unspecified location, I presume in Alaska or somewhere near the Arctic Circle, maybe in Canada, where there was a lake. And they were there at a certain moment observing this lake when all of a sudden from the lake emerges a large UFO and flies away, and they witness it. And he said that they were so close to it, they felt they were in danger to protect themselves. So there's this whole uncanny story, and it goes on to talk about Ingo Swann's remote viewings of the moon and to the far side of the moon, where he encounters inhabitants at the paranormal level who are aware of him being there, even though he's, of course, he's not there. He's in a laboratory or perhaps in his home doing remote viewing. But they, in effect, can detect his presence and they kick him out of the moon. He can't even prevent them from doing that. They make him leave. And that's also in the book. And so Daz Smith was curious, were there other witnesses? And he tracked down people who were working with Ingo Swann on that project. So what can I tell you about it? It's still a mystery to me. What was really going on? Ingo's book is so full of circumstances that seem so very unusual, yet everybody who knew Ingo said he didn't play around. He didn't joke about these things. There's every reason to think he was being quite sincere. And yet at the same time, the story is so incredible. People are still trying to puzzle it together.
Do you know if other remote viewers have tried to look at the moon and seen the same things?
There was a remote viewer who worked with Ingo on the original project, and Daz Smith has managed to reach out to that person, although at the time I interviewed him, he wasn't able to tell me anything further, and I don't know if he subsequently has or not. I'm not aware of any further developments on it. Yes, other remote viewers have looked at the moon and the far side of the moon, and I suppose have attempted to actually find out what it was precisely that Ingo was describing. The problem is that when you use remote viewing, or which is really just a fancy way of thinking about clairvoyance, or seeing at a distance, or psychic perception at a distance, to look at a target like that, an unknown target for which you have no other independent physical validation, it's hard to evaluate. So different remote viewers come up with their scenarios of what they experience looking at the same situation. And for all I know, even if their descriptions exactly match those of Ingo Swann, they could be simply reading his mind and tuning into the things that he claims to have experienced rather than any other objective reality out there. So there are limits to what you can ascertain using remote viewing as a methodology.
And I suppose as there has been remote viewing targets on Earth and that were later verified, that might lend a bit of weight to the remote viewing that was done on the moon, even though we don't have any proof what they saw was right.
Well, that's true. And in fact, a book was recently published along those lines. The name of the book is called Project 8200, The Original Remote Viewing Transcripts, UFO UAP, Bases and Activities, by Frederick H. Atwater, also known as Skip Atwater. He's one of the people who founded the remote viewing unit at Fort Meade in Maryland, where remote viewers were trained and worked for various government agencies for a 20-year period. And he was one of the founders of that unit, and he became the chief trainer at that unit. And this book describes exactly what you're talking about, because now we have groups of remote viewers who have been independently studied on physical targets, both at Fort Meade and at SRI International. And one of those remote viewers was a fellow named Pat Price. He was one of the very best of all the remote viewers. He was so good that the CIA said, we want to hire him directly, and he should work for us instead of working at SRI, because he showed an ability to use remote viewing to break into secret locations and actually come up with secret code words that were used in those locations. So the CIA wanted to keep a close eye on him. Unfortunately, he died shortly after that under mysterious circumstances, and his death is still a mystery. But before he died, while he was still working at SRI International, on one occasion, he showed up at the offices there, and he talked to Hal Puthoff, who was one of the chief researchers at that time, a physicist doing remote viewing research. And he said to Hal, oh, by the way, on my spare time, I decided to scan the Earth and see if I could locate any UFO bases of operation. And I found four of them. And I made detailed notes on each of the four bases, and he handed them off to Hal Puthoff. And Hal, of course, being under government contract, duly reported that up the chain of command. Nothing further was done about it for quite a while, for several years, until at some point Skip Atwater received the detailed transcripts and information from Hal Puthoff. And Skip thought, well, this is very interesting. We could use these four targets, which were typically inside of mountains, located in different locations, one in Alaska, one was in Australia, another couple were located in, I've got the book right in front of me, but I'm not sure the specific locations. But Atwater decided, why don't I give those same locations as targets to the trainees I am working with, just as a training exercise, nothing further. And the targets were given to other remote viewers who were part of the Fort Meade program. And they did come up with descriptions remarkably similar to the ones that were produced by Pat Price. And these are remote viewers who did have measurable track records looking at physical targets. Still, however, there's no yet independent validation. Nobody has gone and located these secret UFO installations buried inside of mountains. Nobody has ever found them, and there's no way to know whether they were actually viewing the caves, as it were, where these UFO bases supposedly were, or whether they were simply viewing whatever imagery Pat Price had originally come up with himself. So, but there you have it. Somebody thought highly enough of this data that they published it in a book. And so the book contains all the remote viewing transcripts from Pat Price and all the other remote viewers who have looked at these four different sites. And they do apparently contain detailed descriptions of four different UFO operational centers supposedly on our planet.
I wanted to change the subject now. I wanted to ask you about the alien abduction phenomenon, because you talked to John Mack and Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal. But first of all, when you first heard about this phenomenon, what did you think about it?
Well, UFO abductions have been in the news since the 1960s. The most famous case from that era was that of Betty and Barney Hill, a mixed-race couple living in the East Coast. In fact, I met Betty Hill when I was still a graduate student at Berkeley in parapsychology. One of my dissertation advisors happened to be James Harder, who was a hydraulic engineer in the hydraulic engineering department, but he was also the researcher, the director of research for a civilian UFO research group called APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, which back in those days in the 1970s was one of the premier UFO research organizations, and they specialized in looking at UFO abduction cases. And Harder himself, my professor, specialized in hypnotizing the witnesses of these cases to see if he could glean further information about them. And so back when I was still a graduate student in the 1970s, Harder introduced me to Betty Hill. And back in those days, there was also the famous case, it's still being celebrated and documented and written about in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And in fact, if you go down to Pascagoula, you'll see a big plaque along the Pascagoula River where the two fishermen, Charles Hickson and the other name escapes me at the moment, they were fishing when they were apparently abducted by some sort of strange aliens aboard a UFO. They reported it to the local sheriff. Their stories checked out. There were also other independent witnesses. Harder came and interviewed them. The case was all over the news back in the 1970s. And so I was, of course, perfectly accepting of this data when John Mack wrote his famous book on abductions. He took it very seriously. He realized that there were dozens of these cases being reported. They had many similarities. And he took them at face value, which really was found to be very threatening to his colleagues at Harvard University. They launched an investigation of the man. And if it wouldn't have been a terrible embarrassment for them, a total violation of academic freedom to kick him out of Harvard because of his interest in this phenomena. So they, you know, they quietly dropped all of their charges against him, and the thing blew over, and he continued to write about these things. And when I interviewed him, he had come to the point of view, really a similar point had been expressed earlier by Jacques Vallée, one of the premier UFO researchers, who's also in our new book, UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? But the point being that there's an enormous similarity between the cases and the reports of UFO abductees and UFO contactees and all of the folklore associated with shamanism, with fairies, with what we might call the super sensible reality, the world of inside of consciousness itself, where, for example, fairies sometimes are said to abduct people, and shamans report, in fact, indigenous people throughout the world report contact with what they sometimes call the star people, non-human beings who are from elsewhere. So there's a long history of this sort of thing, and it's remarkably similar to the contemporary reports from people who associate it with aliens from outer space. But in other cultures or generations, it might be thought of as angels or demons, or in Islamic countries, the jinns, or demigods, or devas, or asuras. So there's very rich folklore about these things. And the difference being that, of course, we assume the folklore refers to products of the imagination, whereas the UFO sightings seemingly involve physical reality. But as a parapsychologist, I've come to accept that sometimes products of the imagination are so powerful that they can manifest in the physical world. I'll give you an example of that. There are people who can project apparitions of themselves. In fact, a book about it was written in the 19th century by some of the founders of the Society for Psychical Research in England. It was called Apparitions of the Living. People can project images of themselves. And not only that, they might not look like themselves. You could project an image, but you could make it look like somebody else or like a creature from elsewhere. And sometimes those images, these apparitions, appear to be very, very physical. There are cases in the literature of bilocation, where somebody projects an image of themselves. It can knock on the door. Somebody opens the door. The doorbell rings. Somebody walks in. They appear to be quite physical. They can sit down and have tea and cookies with you and then leave. And all the whole time, the actual person was hundreds of miles away at a different location. So paranormal abilities don't seem to have the same constraints that we would infer on mere imagination. That, in fact, the philosopher Henri Corbin tried to make a distinction between what he called the imaginal and imagination. Imagination, like Disney cartoons. We all experience daydreaming and imagination, but some of us have cultivated our powers of imagination to such an extent that they can actually assume physical form. At least the literature in the archives of the Society for Psychical Research provides examples of this, and as well as our anthropological studies of, for example, what are known in Tibet as tulpas, where the Tibetan lamas, who are highly trained in the art of imagination, meditation, concentration, can concentrate on a particular image, a figure, could be a human, or could be a deity, to the point where that person or that image takes on such a strong reality that many people see it. And people even interact with it in a physical way.
This kind of reminds me of something Jeffrey Kripal says in your book about when he was sharing a room with Whitley Strieber, and one night when he was asleep, it felt like he'd split off into a second person and even heard himself say, "Oh my God."
Yes. In fact, I've invited Whitley Strieber to come here. I've interviewed Whitley many times. I consider him a person of high integrity, even though he began his career as a writer of horror stories. So one might think that all of his books about what he calls the visitors and his own abduction are merely products of his brilliant ability to write fiction. He insists that they're not. And Jeffrey Kripal warned me, said, if you invite him to your home, you better be prepared for what might manifest around him. And he still has an open invitation to come here, but he hasn't yet done so. But yes, Jeffrey Kripal invited him to Esalen, and I believe they shared a room together at the Esalen Institute in California. And Kripal was awakened in the middle of the night by some disturbance that struck him as something frightening, something related to the very thing that Whitley Strieber complains about. And now this is the dark side of these UFO abductions. You know, Whitley Strieber wrote this wonderful book, a bestseller called Communion, and the title was suggested by his wife, incidentally. But he describes it, you know, as a very frightening experience. He was abducted, and apparently various medical procedures were performed on him, including sticking some kind of a probe up his rectum. And he tells me, decades after the event, he still has to put some sort of lotion there because it caused some injury to him. And so many people say, this is not a friendly thing. This isn't a spiritual communion, as Whitley describes. This is an invasion. This is a violation of his bodily integrity, and it's evil. It's something that demons would do. And there are people who think exactly that, you know, UFOs must be demonic for the way they abduct people and perform surgeries on them or pregnancies. But there are also examples of healing as well. And I think if you were to talk to Whitley Strieber, he would say overall the experience was positive and beneficial to him. His critics would say, yeah, but people who were prisoners in concentration camps often develop similar attitudes. People who have been kidnapped sometimes, like Patty Hearst, the famous heiress who was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army in the 1970s and later joined them. It's a known phenomenon. People sometimes become sympathetic to their torturers. So I don't know quite what to make of it. I would say the psychiatric profession has not come around to recognizing the reality of these experiences. People, they're very real to the people who have them, but we don't have independent evidence. And so there's the thought that maybe it's just something, a meme, that is spreading because people read about it. But then you find that people, we had during the experiment I told you about in San Francisco in 1976, there was a UFO abduction that took place. And we interviewed that person and he had no knowledge of or interest in this sort of thing. So if he was influenced by a meme, it would have been unconscious, maybe even telepathic for all I know. But whatever is going on, they're pretty good at not leaving physical traces behind. In fact, Jacques Vallée even writes about how when there is physical evidence, it sometimes mysteriously disappears after the fact, as if they can leave evidence, enough evidence to really convince the witnesses that whatever happened to them was real, but then the evidence vanishes. So we are dealing with a very, very elusive kind of phenomenon. Although, of course, now since in this century, starting in about 2004 and becoming very public in 2017, when the New York Times published articles about it, the United States Navy has released all sorts of physical evidence from radar sightings and videotape taken from jet aircraft showing pilots, you know, chasing UFOs right over the Pacific Ocean near Southern California. So, you know, it does seem as if slowly, very, very slowly, more evidence is sort of trickling into public awareness. And that seems to confirm the supposition by Jacques Vallée and others that the UFOs are part of what he would think of as a control system, or they're trying to manipulate us at a subconscious level. And what that manipulation is about is hard to say. Maybe it's just, you know, to accept that we are, or to prepare us, one might say, for contact with non-human beings from elsewhere. Where that elsewhere is, whether it's another planet, another galaxy, a star system, or another dimension of space, or perhaps a civilization that exists underwater or inside the Earth. All of those hypotheses remain open at this point.
And I think John Max says something in your book where he kind of says what is occurring is reconnecting us with Source. And they can't wait for the whole world to become Buddhist monks. So they're doing something more intrusive, which is maybe what the abductions are. They're giving everyone a quick, hard hit.
Well, now you're getting down to deep philosophical questions. And of course, one of my big interests is the question of mysticism. Mysticism is a viewpoint you can find in every culture. And the fundamental premise of mysticism is that the universe is one, and we are one with it. In other words, at the deepest level of our psyche, of our consciousness, we are ultimately one with everything, one with all the stars and all the planets and all the galaxies and all the creatures. So that ultimately, the discovery of non-human intelligences, could be animal intelligences or aliens from some other place, we're really only discovering who we are at the deepest level. And I think there's a real truth to that. I think ultimately, all discovery is a form of self-discovery. Now, mysticism is not particularly popular in the academic circles. We live in a materialistic culture where the idea that consciousness is primary, that consciousness is what links us to everything else, and that everything emerges out of what you could call mind at large, that's a mystical idea. But of course, it's also an idea that is shared by people who have had psychedelic experiences or near-death experiences. So I would say that there is an awakening of consciousness on this planet. The spread of Buddhism is one example of it, where you now find mindfulness meditation centers in every town, pretty much, and of course, yoga as well. The idea that the deep self is one with the entire universe is an idea that comes out of the Hindu tradition and their famous equation, Atman, or the soul, equals Brahman, or the essence of the universe. So To me, this is a very important philosophical idea. It has implications for science, certainly for the science of parapsychology. I think it is ultimately how we explain remote viewing, which we've been talking about. How is it that the human mind is able to access information from almost any point in time and space? We don't know of any blocks or obstacles that prevent the mind, although it's still a very primitive ability, I guess you could say. And by that, I mean, it's not highly developed in human beings. It works. It works very well. And in scientific studies, we have enormous statistical evidence for it. But you, still, if you want to go to work in the morning, you drive your car typically or take the bus. You don't use a flying carpet. It's not as if we all have magical powers to that level. It's still sort of a, you know, we're taking baby steps, you might say, in terms of the mystical or psychic or paranormal awakening of humanity. But if in my lifetime, I got a doctoral degree in parapsychology in 1980, so I can look back now 44 years and see how the field has progressed. It's actually over a decade, I mean, over a half century, to be precise, since I began my doctoral research in the field. And I can see we're making progress. So I can well imagine if we project that into the future, 200 or 300 or 500 years from now, or 1,000 years from now, what will human civilization be like? It may well be that these abilities, which are highly cultivated in a few rare individuals, the Ingo Swans of the world, or the Ted Owens or Uri Gellers, might be quite widespread.
But do you feel there's a trickster element to UFOs, where they're kind of putting on a front, or a kind of the theater of UFOs and abductions, but what's actually going on is something different? And maybe when we start to get an idea of it, then they change it.
Yes, I think that's true. The idea that evidence is presented, which then seems to vanish, would be an example of that. And it's not just UFOs, it's the entire range of paranormal phenomena. I think there's a fellow named Ray Hernandez who's written a book called The Mind of God, and he suggests that whether it's UFOs or near-death experiences or communication with angels or out-of-body experiences or communication with the deceased, all of these things are manifestations of the mind of God, and they're all really related to each other, and they kind of beckon us. They are ways of enticing us to begin exploring our own depths. And there is a trickster element to it, indeed. In fact, there's a parapsychologist named George Hansen who wrote a book called The Trickster and the Paranormal. And he looks at the archetype of the trickster, a character you find in many, many cultures. Probably almost every mythology has a trickster figure. It's quite pronounced where I live in the American Southwest, where the Native Americans have a figure known as Kokopele, who is a trickster figure, very popular. You'll see images of Kokopele all over the American Southwest. And it does suggest that reality, you might say the deep levels of reality, or if you prefer, the mind of God, it has a sense of humor.
I wanted to get back to Whitley Strieber, and one thing I read in the book was they talked about when he had visitors to his cabin, it was almost like people wanted to experience something. And there was a time there was one couple who saw small blue ETs, but then there was a couple in another bedroom who's got a visit from their dead friend.
Well, isn't that fascinating? Yes. In Whitley Strieber's work, there's a very distinct overlap between the realm of these He calls them the visitors, and he has described many different shapes and forms and colors of these visitors. And sometimes they appear with individuals who he knows to be deceased, or later discovers were deceased individuals. And it would make sense. Now, I myself have a strong interest in the afterlife. I think you know I wrote an essay for the Bigelow Institute competition on the best evidence for survival after death that won the grand prize. And so the evidence for an afterlife, for the survival of consciousness after death, in my view, is overwhelming, is very, very strong. And it's evidence that comes from many different directions. It's not just what we learn from spiritualist mediums, or not just what we learn from the near-death experience, or not just what we learn from the reports of young children who remember past lives, but all of these things together and more. So, assuming that there is an advanced culture somewhere, let's just say hypothetically in another planet, why, they would know about these things if they're advanced. They would have at least as much knowledge of the afterlife as we have. Now, we have a vast knowledge, although if you talk to people in academia, they'll pretend that there's no knowledge at all. They'll say, not a shred of evidence. I've heard that phrase too many times. But I have to assume that an advanced alien race would understand it completely. They would realize that we are embedded in a world of consciousness, and that world of consciousness has infinitely many dimensions to it, that it's unlimited in terms of possibilities. And so it includes things like reincarnation and life after death and other planets and other ways of being in the world, that the awakening of human consciousness incorporates all of these things. The Buddhists talk about, you know, the 10,000 Buddha realms, for example. So I'm sympathetic to Ray Hernandez's idea that all of this is manifestations of the mind of God, ultimately. Or if you don't like a term with religious connotations like the mind of God, some more secular philosophers simply call it mind at large.
Well, we've been talking about your book. It's called UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? And people can get that on Amazon and other places.
Yes, they can get it on Amazon. And I now understand you could go into any bookstore and ask them to order it for you if you would like to patronize a bookstore. The book is published by White Crow Books, based in the United Kingdom, and can be ordered from their website as well. But I suppose for convenience sake, Amazon is the best.
And can you tell us about your other books?
Yeah, we have an imprint, I guess that's the best way to think of it, with White Crow Books. And the imprint is called New Thinking Aloud Dialogues. So all of these books contain transcripts of my interviews on the New Thinking Aloud channel. And the first book in the series is called Is There an Afterlife? And it includes a dozen interviews on the topic of life after death. The second book of the series is about my dear friend, the parapsychologist Russell Targ, and it was a book we published in honor of his 90th birthday. It contains 15 interviews with Russell. Now, he's one of the people who pioneered remote viewing at SRI International and did all of this work with the CIA and the DIA and many other three-letter agencies working for the government. That work went on for 20 years. consistent government funding. And the reason they got consistent government funding for all that time is because they were successful in helping government agencies solve problems for which they had no other solution, like apprehending drug runners bringing illegal drugs into the United States, or finding kidnapped people, or spying on various secret locations inside the Soviet Union. Basically, the government shut that program down in 1996 after the Cold War ended. However, all of the data is still available, and Russell Targ lived through it and provides a very eloquent first-person perspective of what that was like.
And you have a YouTube channel.
The YouTube channel is New Thinking Aloud. And incidentally, it's a play on words, so it's not A-L-O-U-D, it's A-L-L-O-W-E-D. And your listeners can visit our YouTube channel by going to newthinkingaloud.com.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
It's been a pleasure, Simon.
And that was an interview with Jeffrey Mishlove about his book, UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. There are two tiers. In the $3 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And in the $6 a month tier, you get an extended episode every week. And my website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And there's a thing in the interview with John Mack where he mentions a woman who believed herself to be the reincarnation of a being, that she was an alien in a past life.
Well, why not? If we certainly have enormous evidence for reincarnation in this planet, you know, at the University of Virginia, they have a database of something like 20... 20-